True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Beth Lochtefeld was smart and hardworking, and by the time she reached her 40s, she had good friends, she'd traveled the world, and she was professionally successful. So all that was missing was a partner with whom to share her life. Enter Tom Tulin III. At age 37, Manhattanite Tom was well-educated, handsome, and he appeared successful in his own right. But he had secrets. His life was spiraling out of control, and he would try to pull Beth into that spiral with him. By the time Beth broke up with Tom Tulin, it was too late for her to escape him unscathed. He went into an alcohol-enhanced rage and held her against her will in his apartment overnight before she was able to escape while he slept. Join us at the quiet end for No Safe Harbor. After fleeing Tulin's New York apartment, Beth fled to Nantucket and stayed at her brother's house on the island, hiding from him. Once she felt like the coast was clear, she took refuge in her own Nantucket rental. But once she entered, she would never be seen alive again. Sad story, and let's have a sad beer.
Okay. Well, the name is kind of sad.
That's what I thought, yeah.
So I'm having a Nantucket beer. How about that? This is Gray Lady from Cisco Brewers in Nantucket. And the Gray Lady is a reference to the fog that creeps in from time to time. Actually, more than from time to time. Frequently on Nantucket. So this is a wheat beer. It's a hazy pale gold color, little white head, a bit of citrus and hay in the aroma, some lemon and sweet malt in the taste. It's pretty bland. It just didn't have a lot of flavor, a lot of aroma. I shouldn't have picked it.
No. Well, I don't think there are a lot of beers on Nantucket to choose from, in your defense. And sometimes a bland beer, if the flavor's okay, it's good with some chips and vinegar, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, I looked at this because this is kind of their flagship beer. I've actually reviewed, I think, a half dozen of Cisco's beers, so I could have picked another one. But I picked Gray Lady because that's the one they're mainly known for, I think.
Well, and I like the name.
Me too.
Yeah. It's kind of maudlin artsy. I like it. So let's open it up.
And we'll head down to the quiet end.
Oh, so peaceful down here. I want to snuggle up, drink a bland beer, and talk about a really fascinating case, which has a lot of sadness to it, of course.
Yeah, this is a tough one.
You say that every week.
They're all tough.
They are all tough. Okay, fair enough. Why don't you get us started?
I'll start. So Elizabeth Ann Lochtefeld was born April of 1960 in Erie, Pennsylvania. She was the third child of John and Judy Lochtefeld. John was a teacher in a small women's college in Erie. Then in 1964, he took a job as an art professor at Kutztown State Teachers College. The Lochtefeld family then moved to Topton, which is a small town in the Amish region of Pennsylvania. Beth began kindergarten in Topton's Long Swamp Elementary, and the family lived in a rented Dutch colonial house. John used the summer kitchen as his art studio. Now, their landlord lived just down the road on a farm where they had pigs, horses, and huskies. So in the winter months, they would take the Lochtefeld children on dog sled rides.
So it's kind of painted by Beth's family as idyllic.
That sounds pretty nice.
Yeah, it does.
Although they enjoyed their life there, John and Judy wanted to own their own home for their family. So in the summer of 1966, John was offered a job at Marymount College, and this is a small school overlooking the Hudson River in New York State. So that August, the family moved into a house of their own in Peekskill, New York, in Westchester County. This was a rural community woodlands and farmland in just the early stages of new housing developments.
Yes, so Beth attended Van Cortlandville Elementary School and Walter Panis High School. She rode her bike down the quiet streets, and sometimes she fished with her brothers off Pump House Bridge, which was less than a half mile's walk from their own backyard. Beth herself, she took piano lessons. She also sang in her school's chorus. She wasn't a great athlete, but she did run track for a while, and she played intramural volleyball. But what stood out about Beth was not her athletic ability. It was her ability to laugh at herself and to be an encouraging part of the team. So people just enjoyed being on her team. The Lochtefeld children participated in scouting throughout their childhoods. The two boys were Cub and Boy Scouts. Beth and her sister Kathy were Brownies and then Girl Scouts. Their mother Judy, a former Girl Scout herself, volunteered as their troop leader. Beth and her sister went on troop hikes and they sold Girl Scout cookies. They went on trips to Amish country in Washington, D.C. As scout leader, Judy was really involved, and her enthusiasm spread to her girls. So both Beth and Kathy excelled at scouting. Beth reached the highest level achievable, as did Kathy, and that's first-class scout. When Beth was a high school sophomore, she received a letter from the then-president of the U.S., Jimmy Carter, and he congratulated her on her achievement. Beth's strong work ethic was likely influenced by her mother. Judy had graduated from Michigan State University with honors. When her children were older, she took a job as a substitute teacher with the local school system. And later, when her children began leaving for college, she went back to school to get her master's degree. Then she became a full-time elementary school teacher, and she just loved it.
Hard worker.
They all seemed to be, yes.
Now, the family spent their Christmases with friends of the family and their summers on Nantucket Island. Now, even though Beth really loved her summers there, she hated leaving her friends behind. And one of Beth's best friends from middle school and high school would recall that she and Beth cried at the end of each school year. At summer's end, she'd go through the same sadness when leaving her Nantucket friends.
When Beth started high school, she was tall and she had that Farrah Fawcett-style feathered hair. She wore oversized aviator glasses, too. Her first love was a star football player named Tony. Beth was fair and blonde, while Tony had a full head of black hair, and at a young age, he was able to grow a full beard. Beth was 5'9", so she was at least an inch taller than Tony, so they looked a little bit like opposites, but they really had a lot in common. They were both honor students and took the same classes. Beth was consistently among the top students of her class, and Tony was usually in the top 10 as well. Tony first showed interest in Beth before his football practice one day. Then he ended up taking her to the fall dance. And from that night on, she and Tony were inseparable.
Tony liked being with Beth's family quite a bit. John Lochtefeld tapped the maple trees in his yard each winter, and he made maple syrup and maple candy. This impressed Tony. It impresses me, too. You ever done that?
I've never done it, but I do enjoy the fruits of the labor.
Yeah, it's very laborious.
Yeah, it
although
takes
I guess
so
it can
much.
Automate it a little bit. But, you know, you'd have to collect like 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. I mean, holy cow.
Oh, but it's so worth it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's great stuff.
Yeah,
nothing
exactly.
Better than homemade maple syrup.
No, nothing.
So Tony liked to go to the Lochtefeld house Sunday mornings when Judy made stacks of pancakes for everyone. It was so interesting being around them, Tony remembered. He became friends with Beth's brother Tommy, and they would talk about sports or pass a football back and forth together. Dates with Beth were often spent in the Lochtefeld family living room, where they would watch TV or play Monopoly.
Yeah, so they liked to hang out with her family.
Yeah.
Beth was also the senior editor of the high school yearbook. She and Tony talked about colleges, and Tony wanted to go to West Point. There, he would play football and prepare for a career in the military. In his senior year, Tony played lacrosse, and Beth was involved with student government, and she was also working on organizing the school yearbook. Beth and Tony were chosen best couple by their classmates. Beth and Tony's relationship lasted through the summer of 1978, but it fell apart when they both went away to college.
Well, it happens to a lot of those high school romances.
It does, yeah. So according to Tony, their breakup was mutual, but maybe more mutual for her. According to friends, Beth told Tony she was breaking up in a letter. Tony had begun his classes at West Point, and Beth was at Notre Dame. So Tony took the breakup harder than Beth, although they both knew that the distance was just too much and they wouldn't be able to maintain their relationship. Over the next few years, their lives took them in very different directions. Tony left West Point after only one semester. He got married and eventually moved out to California. Beth graduated from Notre Dame and moved to Manhattan. She would start her own business there by the time she was in her late 20s, helping architects navigate the New York City building regulations. Pretty complicated thing to do. But her business did very well and ended up making her a millionaire.
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed with, you know, you graduate college, move to New York City, and start this business. In a million years, I wouldn't think that I could think of something about helping architects navigate building regulations. I mean, that's just not something that would be on my radar.
Well, she didn't go right from college to that. She worked as a waitress for a while, then she got into a business doing similar things, and then she, when she was in her late 20s.
Yeah.
Still pretty but young.
Very.
Yes.
Yeah, and she did this, I think, on her own, right?
Yes, very independent young woman.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So Tom Tulin's parents both worked as teachers. In 1967, Tom's mother, Dolores, started a private school in a local church. Tom's sister, Tara, was 3 years older than Tom. It was the perfect way for Dolores to work and care for her daughter at the same time. The timing of starting the school turned out to be perfect as well. As the neighborhood grew and the residents became wealthier, the school grew. By the mid-70s, her Carroll Street School had expanded up to the sixth grade, and in 1982, the 100-year-old Berkeley Institute, a prestigious Brooklyn preparatory school, offered a partnership, and together they created the Berkeley Carroll School. So the school was incredibly competitive. Applications for the preschool program began 6 months before the school year began, and parents of prospective students who were 3 and 4 year olds would sleep in their cars outside of the school office the night before the applications were made available. And they did that just to make sure that they got one for their child. And mind you, filling out the application would not guarantee admission. As the founder of the Carroll Street School and the director of admissions, Dolores Tulin was in a position to help some influential people.
So it looks to me like Tom came from money, whereas Beth made her own money.
It's a little bit of a simplification, but yes, I think that Tom definitely grew up with more advantages.
Well, yeah.
But years later, Tom would brag that his mother and U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer were good friends. Tom grew up in a life full of focused and constant social climbing. So on one hand, people close to Tom would describe him as a devoted son who always spoke of his mother in loving terms. He told at least one girlfriend that his mom, in her younger days, had looked like Marilyn Monroe. And one former girlfriend remembered him constantly being on the phone with his mom. But other friends said that his relationships with both his mother and father were distant. To a therapy group he attended once, Tulin described both of his parents as detached and aloof. From a very early age, he was expected to behave a certain way. He claimed that as a kid, he would roam the streets of Brooklyn alone, wandering into some tough neighborhoods. He'd tell people he was from Brooklyn, but he'd leave out that he was from a very gentrified section. The young Tom Tulin walked to private school in a uniform of gray trousers, a blue button-down shirt, a plaid tie, and a sweater. He was always clean and well-groomed. But that's not the image he wanted to portray to other students.
Tom attended Xavier, which was a Jesuit high school in Manhattan. And he also got himself a fake ID so he could go out drinking on weekends. According to the school yearbook, he belonged to the drama club all 4 years, but he was not listed as a cast member in any of the senior productions. And he was not in the group photo of the senior council either, which he listed under his graduation picture as part of his accomplishments. But, like Beth, he was in the National Honor Society, However, he was overshadowed by his older sister's accomplishments. When Tulin was in high school, his sister graduated magna cum laude from Yale, and she is working on a master's degree in biology at Fordham. She is also married, and her wedding made it into the New York Times.
Which is really a pretty big deal. Only the high society types get into the New York Times generally.
Well, I thought you had to pay.
That might be true also, but they won't just take anybody off the street.
Oh, of course not.
Nothing in Tulin's yearbook showed that he was anything besides a normal kid, though. It would be in Paris that the worst part of his character would come to the surface. So in his senior year of high school, Tom Tulin, along with classmates Lawrence Rivera and Steve Doran, studied in France. According to the school, participation in the exchange program was only for academically qualified students. Tulin was in his third year of the French club. So the trip was 6 weeks in Paris living with a French family and studying at a Catholic secondary school. Tulin's host family lived in a wealthy area, and he attended a Jesuit school near the Eiffel Tower. The opportunity was exceptional and was meant to give students wonderful memories and experiences. But for Tom Tulin, the trip became just an extended drunken binge that began on his flight over. Once in Paris, his hosts were this wealthy Lebanese family, and they really disapproved of him because he would stumble home drunk in the early hours. One night, he tried to steal a car for a joyride, but that adventure was ended when he couldn't drive a manual transmission. He approached prostitutes several times, and when he tried to duck out without paying one woman, two men beat him with tire irons. He also urinated on a female artist on the street in the middle of the day. So he went kind of wild in a very negative way.
Boy, it sounds like he was on his own, no parental influence. Let's have fun.
Yeah, it's a little strange. And he did some worrying things that would make you think, yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if he ended up killing someone someday.
Well, just that story about this balloon ride.
Yeah, tell us that one, because that is shocking.
Well, they were nearing the end of their Paris trip, and Tulin and his classmate Doran and two French teenagers took a hot air balloon ride. So they're up, I don't know, 400 or 500 feet. Tulin decided to frighten one of the French teens by threatening to push her over the edge of the basket. So he held her by her legs and had her upper body hanging over the edge. That's kind of frightening.
Kind of frightening?
But
that's horrifying.
What was most frightening, at least for those inside the basket, was the look in Tom Tulin's eyes. To his classmate Doran, it seemed like he really would drop the girl.
Well, and who would even risk that? If her body's hanging over, she could slip.
Yeah, it doesn't take much to...
And it's, of course, it would be sure death.
Yeah, 500 feet.
And I can't believe that when she got down, there were no charges against him. That's just a horrible, horrible thing to do.
Yes, it is.
So when he got back to New York, Tom Tulin seemed like pretty much just a different person. Though he was still a teenager, he had gotten really comfortable with the world of alcohol and sex, and he was just loving it. Back in Manhattan, he spent his weekends in hangouts like the Palladium and Studio 54, and sometimes a friend would go with him, but sometimes he'd go out alone. He had no problem with that. It was during his solo excursions that he would go to Greenwich Village, drink to excess, and run out on the check. With a number of bars and restaurants there, he could do this every night for a year and not visit the same place twice. So he thought this was just great.
Yeah, I would just point out, a teen who doesn't mind going out by himself and drinking to excess, there's a problem there.
Yeah, you think?
Nope.
Oh yeah, he was an alcoholic way back then.
Certainly. Yeah, he must have been.
Yes. And the worst of his character traits were amplified when he was drunk. One of them was his penchant for cruelty to others. Under the front of joking, he would surprise people on the street, sometimes even elderly men or women, by sneaking up on them and pulling his arm back in a threatening way and yelling, "I should give you the back of my hand." Now, most of these people didn't think it was funny at all. They were terrified and angry. But even though he said he was only joking, he didn't seem to care how other people took it. He just got a kick out of it himself. That wasn't impressive to anyone. Why would it be?
It wouldn't be.
So, like we were saying, by the time he was a senior in high school, He was likely an alcoholic, and his life just became unmanageable. Even in an atmosphere where beer drinking is expected, an all-boys high school, his drinking was very excessive. Because of his drinking and his behavior, he actually lost most of his friends. We don't really know how his family handled his problems, or even if they were fully aware, but they had to have some idea. And later on, they would say that they had tried to help him several times. But his problems did get much worse.
Yeah, Tom attended Columbia, pretty good school. Well, after college, he worked selling cars for a while, and then eventually got a job at Smith Barney. And he even worked for a while as a bank executive on Wall Street. So he's having opportunities presented to him.
So many opportunities that he just blew. No appreciation for it, really.
No.
Opportunities that most people would never get.
So Beth was introduced to Tom Toolin by a friend when he was 37 and she was 44. It was Labor Day weekend, 2004, in Nantucket. Beth's friend Bernadette called her up and told her that she thought she'd met her Mr. Right. Beth was excited. Again, she's in her early 40s. She really wants to settle down and find that person to spend the rest of her life with. This sounds good on paper.
Well, yeah, even when she first saw him, it all seemed pretty good. He was charming, good-looking. He was a Catholic. He came from a well-to-do family and seemed very sophisticated. So she seemed to have a lot in common with him. She was taken with him right away, actually, although she was living in Nantucket by this time. And he was still living back in New York, they began to spend a lot of time together. For 6 months prior to meeting her, Toolin was actually sober. He'd been working out at the New York Athletic Club several times a week, and he had lost 40 pounds. So his addiction to drugs and alcohol were in remission.
So was that on his own that he decided to do this?
As far as we know, yeah. He was trying to get it together. Plus, he was tall and handsome, and he really came across as smart, funny, and honest. 7 years younger than Beth, he was kind of like a trophy boyfriend, but better than that, she thought, because he had some culture and intelligence. And even his minimal criminal past had an attraction for Beth, because it was presented as harmless, and it gave him that little bit of bad boy edge. He tried to steal a Roman statue from an art show, and he presented this story as a fun prank. She saw that as him being honest, but he just kind of put a spin on it to make it look more funny than it actually was.
Yeah, like, haha, I wasn't really trying to do this.
Yeah.
It just seemed funny at the time.
But we know he probably was really trying to do it, and he was probably just trashed out of his mind at the time.
Probably.
Probably.
Now, for several weeks, Beth and Toolin went back and forth from his apartment in Manhattan to her cottage on Nantucket. They even met each other's parents. Toolin's over dinner at the New York Athletic Club, and Beth's at John and Judy Lochtefeld's home. Judy had a bad feeling about Toolin. She thought he talked too much, and he did way too much name-dropping. She also didn't like his slicked back hair. It was gross. Now, her husband John liked the fact that Toolin was Catholic, and he was happy that Beth seemed happy. But I'm telling you, based on my experience with you as my wife and mother-in-law to some of our sons-in-laws, you got to say something about mom's intuition.
Yeah, and there have been times I don't want to be right, but the red flags, you just can't miss them.
Yeah, you've been right on point.
I have, yeah. Just one of the things that happen as you get older and more experienced in life, yeah. So on Nantucket, the new couple shared days on the beach and evenings in her cozy cottage. There was laughter and romance. They shared bottles of wine, and he was drinking. But at first, he didn't really seem to get drunk or do anything too inappropriate.
Well, he's just coming off his
sobriety.
Abstinence, yeah, sobriety.
Yeah. So Beth wanted to believe that she'd met the man she'd been waiting for most of her life, and you can't blame her. She felt that the time had come for her to take a chance, and she was ready for marriage and tired of being alone. She had called her younger brother, Tom Lochtefeld, many times after she started seeing Tom Toolin, and at first she was very enthusiastic. "He's just so honest," she told her brother. but Tulin's honesty was really just part of a carefully crafted personality he had portrayed to Beth. He was a man with secrets. No one seemed to know his whole story. He did tell Beth about some embarrassing moments from his past, like the time he was arrested for stealing a 60-pound sculpture from an art show. Tulin, drinking heavily that evening, had slipped the sculpture under his coat and tried to walk out the door, but he was caught by a guard and arrested. In court, his lawyer's defense was that it was a drunken prank, but the statue was actually worth over $80,000, so it wasn't very funny to most people. And I'm sure the guard wasn't amused.
I'm sure he wasn't. And I'm sure he got a heap of shit put on him by Tulin.
Right. And he must have thought, who is this rich asshole who thinks he can do whatever he wants? That's what I would think.
That's how I'd read it, too.
Yes, exactly.
Now, and as time went by, and remember, this is just a matter of weeks. They hadn't been going out that long.
No, it wasn't that long.
So Beth became less enthusiastic about the relationship. There were some concerns about her boyfriend. The way he dressed was one of them. Initially, Beth thought it was really preppy when he wore double-breasted blazers and tasseled loafers, even on casual dates. He even accessorized with pocket handkerchiefs and ascots. One time, he showed up dressed that way for a date at a jazz club, surprising Beth, who was wearing jeans and a leather jacket. So Beth was a smart, worldly woman, and she knew that her boyfriend was pretending to be someone he wasn't. But she could put up with that. There were worse things than overdressing.
Right, so she's making some excuses for him, defending him. He's kind of like a project. And her brother would say that she did have a habit of that, which she isn't the only person. We all have done things like this, some more than others. But if something was wrong with someone, she'd say, well, yeah, but I really like him and we can work on that.
Yeah, still he's a project.
Yes.
But one thing she couldn't rationalize was the presence of a handgun in one of his bedroom drawers. And when she asked him about it, Tulin became really angry and he told her to put it back and mind her own business.
Yeah, so Beth didn't tell anyone about the gun right away. She probably didn't want her family to worry. She really cared about other people's feelings. But the gun and his response to her finding it were definitely red flags. Unless your significant other has a very good reason, a gun in the home can be really concerning, especially when your significant other has a history of instability and addiction.
Very true. So instead of getting out of the relationship, Beth took a trip with Tulin to California. So what, she was going and invited him, or he was going and invited her? So they went together.
They went together. I'm not sure whose idea it was, but instead of breaking up with him, she thought she'd give him a chance and go on this trip.
Yeah, and this was pretty much at the point that she had decided that she's ready to break up with him.
Well, I think she had vacillated. She'd said she was going to break up with him, then she was going to give him another chance. It'd only been a few weeks.
Yeah, in California, the relationship really took a nosedive.
Apparently it did, yeah.
So Tulin proposed marriage, which flattered Beth, but they'd only been seeing each other for 3 weeks, and Tulin had been upsetting to travel with. They missed two of their flights because, according to Beth, he couldn't get his shit together.
Well, that's pretty alarming. How do you miss flights? He had to be in really bad shape.
Yeah.
Apparently, he started drinking really heavily again, and he was also kind of a chain smoker, which she hated.
I mean, these are all perfect reasons to discontinue the relationship. I mean,
oh, absolutely. No one's saying she wouldn't have reason for it.
The alcoholism is a biggie.
That's a big problem, sure.
Yeah.
So Beth told him, you know, it's just too soon in our relationship to even talk about marriage. But he wouldn't take no for an answer. She was actually so freaked out by this abrupt proposal and his overall behavior on the trip that she returned home alone. From there, she emailed friends and vented. She told them he's already talking rings, and his motives for wanting to marry Beth were questionable. She was smart. She knew that she should be suspicious. She wasn't this big multimillionaire, but she was financially very comfortable. The profit from the sale of her business was very significant, and she also owned a co-op in Greenwich Village that would eventually sell for close to $800,000. so he could have seen her as a meal ticket because he was really failing that way.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Absolutely.
His financial situation was as enigmatic as his personality. He worked for Smith Barney in Atlanta and then in Manhattan, and he was fired twice. And later on, he was fired from another bank job because someone there recognized him from the newspaper stories about his attempted theft of the sculpture. In the months before he met Beth, Toulon told friends he was working from his apartment. He was always just about to make that big deal, except for the fact that the big deal never happened.
Oh, I've known these types before.
He had the taste for the finer things in life, but no discernible income. Oh, I can't wait to say that. A champagne taste on a beer income.
Yeah.
All right.
You like that phrase.
So it must have entered Beth's mind that he did want her for her money.
At least partially. I mean, he may have really liked her. He may have been in love with her, but certainly her money was probably a factor. Despite her own success, Beth wanted really badly to be in love and spend her life with someone. There was some emptiness in her life as she watched her parents and her siblings living in happy marriages. So she did look past many of Toulon's flaws, maybe that she shouldn't have, because she knew she was running out of time for the kind of life she wanted. She's in her 40s, so if she wants a family, she's really getting towards the end of a rope there.
Well, yeah, if she wants to have her own baby in her own uterus.
Yeah, maybe she didn't care about that. Maybe she would have been happy adopting.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Adopting is a wonderful thing to do.
The likelihood of her carrying a baby or becoming pregnant and carrying a baby isn't real great.
Well,
I know, it's not zero.
It's not zero, and she probably would have needed some kind of fertility treatment. But maybe she just wanted to have a husband, you know. Maybe kids weren't even a big deal. But still, she's getting to an age where she wants these things. She's accomplished everything she wanted to on her own. So before the California trip with Toulon, Beth had told friends and family members that he might be just the one to settle down with, outwardly at least. Toulon and Beth had the appearance of a pretty perfect couple. It seemed like they could live comfortably in a home in Connecticut or Westchester and summer on Nantucket. Nantucket was the perfect place in her mind for a wedding, and Beth really wanted to see the stars over Nantucket Harbor on her wedding night. While under those stars, after she had returned from California, Beth really started to miss Tom Toulon. He'd called her many times and apologized profusely. Beth had told her brother that she was going to give it the Four Seasons test. So what she would do is stay with him for a year and see how things went. She said, "I'll give him a year." Beth's brother hoped that she would have a man with whom she could spend the rest of her life, but he certainly had doubts about Tom Toulon being that man.
He certainly did. So her brother Tom had met Toulon when he was with Beth one night at the Harvard Club for dinner. Toulon showed up with his blonde hair slicked back, and he is wearing a well-fitted blue pinstripe suit. At 6'2", he was an impressive-looking guy. And even Beth's brother thought that he looked very confident and was taken in by his gentlemanlike manners. They talked about the trip to California, but they didn't discuss the issues that had arisen during the trip. And Toulon told Tom Lochtefeld about Beth helping him with business contacts. But while he's doing that, he's very evasive about his employment. In fact, Beth's brother wasn't convinced that Toulon actually had a job. At one point, Toulon reminisced about a long-ago summer with the Nantucket Theater, and Beth then talked glowingly about a trip they had recently taken to visit Toulon's sister Tara in Westchester. Beth liked Toulon's sister a lot. And maybe she saw in her what she hoped for herself in the future. Happily married, Tara Toulon lived an ideal life with a family and a suburban home.
And that's pretty much all that Beth wanted at this point. Several times during that dinner, Toulon excused himself and left the table for a few minutes. And Beth explained to her brother that he was trying to quit smoking. Now her brother knew she hated smoking. She hated the smell.
Yeah.
So Beth said to her brother, "He knows I don't like it, and he's really trying to make changes." Looking back, it seemed like Beth had been trying to convince herself that Toulon was worthy of her. But the three of them had drinks, and Toulon was on his best behavior that evening. Tom Lochtefeld was walking to Grand Central to catch a train home to Darien afterwards. And he shook hands with Tulin and said goodnight, leaned in and kissed his sister. Then Beth's brother took one more look at his sister as she walked down the street arm in arm with Tom Tulin. Sadly, this was the last time he saw her alive.
And 2 days after that meeting, on a Friday, Beth and Tom Tulin went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Beth had been staying at Tulin's apartment most of that week, since Wednesday night when they'd had dinner at the Harvard Club. Earlier in the day, Tulin had suggested an afternoon at the Met, then some dinner on the East Side. And Beth thought, well, an afternoon at the museum might be a good way to take the pressure off. Because it hadn't been a good idea for her to stay with Tulin for so many days, because his odd behavior and addictions were becoming hard to ignore. The smell of cigarette smoke on his clothing and in his apartment made her almost physically sick. And the memory of that California trip, that really disastrous trip, was still fresh in her mind, too. But she was still clinging on to the idea that the relationship could be saved.
Yeah, Beth tried to treat this like their first date. There'd be no pressure and no drama, she thought. But Tulin had other ideas. After an hour or so, he took Beth by the hand and led her to a quiet corner of the museum. Then he got down on one knee, took an antique ring from the pocket of his sports coat, and proposed. But Beth did not give him the response that he had wanted. When Beth said no, Tulin hissed at her that it was now or never. And Beth said, well, it'll have to be never. She replayed the conversation to her brother in a phone conversation the next day. She had had to hurry to leave the museum, and once at the door, she realized that she had checked her coat. So she searched her pockets for the coat check. But Tulin was following her very quickly and ordering her to stop. Once Beth got her coat and got to the street, she hailed a taxi. But just as she got in, he caught up to her and jumped in beside her. In the cab, she was frightened of him, but she still felt like she had control over the situation. So she decided she would ride it out and go with him. She'd go into his apartment, get her Palm Pilot and some of her clothing, and then she'd be out of his life for good. But once she was inside of his apartment, Beth quickly had to realize that she'd made the wrong decision. She was really in a bad spot. Beth called her brother Tom from inside of Tulin's apartment, and when he picked up, she said, I'm staying here tonight. We're trying to work things out. It was a really strange way to start a conversation, and her words were very measured. But for whatever reason, her brother didn't recognize that maybe she was in distress. But he had no reason to think that, really. He dined with them 2 days earlier, and all had seemed fine.
Yeah, but he didn't know that Tulin had thrown Beth's suitcase into the television, smashing the screen, or that Tulin had told Beth he was going to kill her. He also didn't know that Beth had called his house earlier that evening while he was still on his way home. His mother-in-law, who was staying for the weekend, had picked up the phone. She told her daughter Nancy that she was concerned about Beth. Beth had told her that she was breaking up with Tulin and she wanted to spend the night with Tom and his family.
Yeah, so when Tom heard about that call, he was surprised. It had gone from the Four Seasons test very quickly to, I gotta get out of here. Though he would do anything for his sister, he was confused. We're trying to work things out, Beth had told him. So he said, okay, whatever you want, that's fine. And he hung up the phone. Then as he sat back on his couch, his phone rang again. Beth's caller ID was on his phone. But when he picked up the phone this time, he heard the voice of Tom Tulin. I just wanted to let you know that I love your sister very much, Tulin said. So Beth's brother was kind of annoyed now. He said, fine, and hung up the phone, thinking the two were working things out at Tulin's New York apartment.
The next day, Saturday, Tulin woke up to find Beth gone. The night before, he had held Beth captive. The gun was still in his apartment, and he had been drinking all through the night.
That's scary.
No kidding. His mood with Beth moved from sad and defeatist to frightening and threatening. He didn't pass out until the early morning, and Beth then grabbed her stuff and slipped away. When Tulin woke up and realized Beth was gone, he began calling her cell phone. Now, Beth picked up the first time, instantly regretting it. Tulin had a way of using a little boy's voice to get what he wanted. But Beth told Tulin that it was over, and she let the rest of his calls go direct to voicemail.
Yeah, but he still kept calling all day long, and Beth didn't answer. He dealt with this in the same way he dealt with most of his problems. He began drinking right away. He was seen in the taproom of the New York Athletic Club around noon on Saturday, and in the evening, after hours and hours of drinking, he staggered to the elevator and took it to the 21st floor, where the squash courts were located. And from there, he unsteadily climbed a thin staircase to the atrium on the roof. So according to several sources, a friend of Tulin's saw him climb the staircase and followed him up there. There he talked Tulin down from the ledge, pretty much literally. A taxi stopped in front of Tulin's building at about 11 o'clock that night, just as a neighbor of Tulin's was coming home from walking her dog. The friend from the athletic club had taken Tulin home in a taxi. Tulin had tried to open the front door to his building, but he couldn't get the key in the lock. So the friend took his keys from him and propped him against the wall. And he was leaning against the wall with his head down as his friend got him safely inside his apartment. So the friend had saved him from killing himself, basically. Maybe. We don't know if he was really going to go through with that. But he had to be super drunk by then.
Must have been.
So the friend felt like he was saving him, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think the friend did him a favor.
Well, I guess, but if the friend hadn't saved him, maybe he wouldn't have gone after Beth. Hard to say.
The next morning, which was Sunday, Tulin woke up to the buzz of his apartment intercom. Down in the lobby, his father was waiting for his son to buzz him up. Now, he had been notified by somebody of his son's latest drinking binge, and he was there to save him from self-destructing. The elder Mr. Tulin had watched his son drink himself out of the prestigious Colby College in Maine. He had also been there to see him lose at least 2 banking jobs because of his drinking, once for threatening to punch his boss at a cocktail party. Tulin's parents had tried to get him help for his drinking repeatedly. Quite recently, he had been scheduled to go to a drug and alcohol rehab in Antigua. Tulin had told Beth that he'd been to 3 different alcohol detoxes.
Yeah, I bet there was more.
Probably.
He was 37 by this time. He'd been drinking since his teens. Tulin spoke to his father over the intercom and told him he'd be right down. He showered and changed as his father waited. The plan was probably to get Tulin back to his parents' place and dry him out, and there may have even been plans for another detox or rehab. Once out on the street, a car had double-parked in front of Mr. Tulin's car. The younger Tulin saw his opportunity for escape then. He told his father he would find the owner and have him move his car. So as Mr. Tulin got in behind the wheel of his car, his son walked around the corner of the building and just headed away toward the Dublin House, a bar. As he sat in his car and realized that his 37-year-old son had run away from him like a punished child, Mr. Tulin must have just had enough, because he left without his son.
Now, when Beth had gotten away from Tom Tulin that Saturday morning, she fled to her other brother Peter's house on Nantucket, and she stayed there until Monday, when she felt she was safe, and she returned to her own cottage on the island. She was renting the cottage from the owner, who also lived in a house on the same property.
At 10 minutes after 10 that morning, Tulin walked across the tarmac from the small U.S. Airways commuter plane. He had a silk scarf around his neck, and he was carrying his top coat. He looked like Hugh Jackman coming out of the Waldorf, Dave Murphy, a rental car agent, would later say. So Tulin approached Murphy to ask about a reservation. He had made a reservation, but it was for the day before. Tulin told the rental agent that he was on the island to straighten out some type of situation. Murphy couldn't find Tulin's reservation, but an agent at an adjacent counter overheard the conversation and looked in her company's computer. She found Tulin's reservation for a Ford Escape SUV.
So when Beth pulled into her driveway at her rental house, her landlady was working in the yard. Barbara Kodalak liked Beth. Beth had signed the lease on the cottage the previous March, and Barbara believed that Beth was planning on staying there long term. So Barbara brushed the dirt off her gardening gloves as Beth climbed out of her Subaru. Beth had not been in the cottage for at least a week. Barbara asked how she was doing, and Beth explained that she's just dropped off her boyfriend's clothing at Parcel Plus.
Yeah, so she was mailing his stuff back to him.
Yeah.
Which was nice of her. She didn't have to do that.
No, aren't you supposed to cut it up in a million pieces with scissors?
Only if you're a psycho.
Okay. So Barbara listens sympathetically as Beth told her that she's breaking up with Tulin.
Well, Tulin had been to Beth's cottage before, but Barbara had never met him. So the two women talked for a few minutes, but Beth had some stuff to do. She'd promised her parents, who were due back that evening on the ferry after a trip to upstate New York, that she would make dinner for them. Beth also mentioned to Barbara that she had to pick up her nephew Sam, that was one of Peter's children, at 1 o'clock. So she headed into her cottage as Barbara went back to her gardening.
So once he had arrived in Nantucket and picked up his rental car, he drove that car and parked in a lot across the street from the marina. He walked over to the marina to the back of the shop facing the harbor. And when he walked in, a glass case filled with sporting knives was on his left, and he seemed to see what he wanted right away. He had tried to bring his own knife along with him, but it had been confiscated at the airport.
Yeah, now this was kind of funny, because he tried to bring that with him. He had it in his coat pocket, and then he was giving the agents at the airport different stories why he had it, like ridiculous stories like, oh, I'm bringing it for my sister. She wants to cook, and she asked me to bring a knife.
Yeah.
Ridiculous things like that. So in the shop now, he pointed to a Frost fishing knife with a 4-inch serrated blade and an orange handle. The clerk who sold Tulin the knife told the New York Daily News about Tom Tulin. He looked a little weird.
Inside the cottage, Beth had dinner simmering on the stove as she was working on a project in the guest bedroom. When Tulin drove onto the gravel driveway, Barbara was out working in the yard. She turned and looked and saw a man getting out of an SUV.
It was Tulin.
He wore a top coat, she would say, like a New Yorker, and she wondered if this was Beth's boyfriend trying to make up with her.
Yeah, so apparently Beth hadn't told her some of the really scary stuff about Tulin. Now, it's possible that Tulin opened the front door very quietly, and he may have heard the click of Beth's keyboard coming from the guest bedroom. She was at her computer working, and the bedrooms in the cottage were at the end of a long, narrow hallway. So this layout of the cottage really essentially trapped Beth. She had no way to escape. She likely heard his footsteps and turned away from the desk, but by then, he would have been through the doorway and coming at her. With the first stab of the knife, the blade deflected off the band of Beth's watch and cut into the flesh of her left arm. But again and again, he stabbed at her, and Beth fought back. At least one of the killer's first jabs cut Beth deeply because there was a lot of her blood left on the single bed that was in her office. But at some point early on in the attack, Tulin moved away for a second because Beth was able to get by him and into the hallway. He grabbed her head from behind, he ripped out the back of an earring, and Beth was just 10 feet away from the front door and must have known her life depended on reaching that door to get away from him.
Beth Lachtefeld died in the living room of her cottage. Her knuckles were cut and scraped from trying to defend herself. There were cuts from the knife all over her arms. According to the coroner, at least 6 of the stab wounds in her body could have killed her. He had hit her in the face with the handle end of the knife in his fist. One side of her face was orange and purple. There was a wound to her throat and to her heart. Maybe the last thing Beth saw was her killer standing over her with the bloody knife still in his hand.
What a horrible thought.
Maybe the last thing that Beth Lachtefeld saw was the look of sadness or panic in his eyes, or it could be a look of angry satisfaction.
We don't know. But in the bathroom, the killer would have seen the splatter of Beth's blood on his face and clothing. So Tulin took off his bloody clothing, he took a shower using Beth's soap and towels, and in the sink he washed the knife. He had to get out of there soon before being discovered. He went back into Beth's office, and for some reason he took her Palm Pilot and her cell phone. Then he stepped over Beth's body and left, pulling the door closed behind him. Around 12:30 p.m., Barbara Kodalak looked over at the cottage and saw that Beth's Subaru was still parked out front. She remembered that Beth was supposed to pick up her nephew Sam from school. Then a bunch of disconnected thoughts began to fall into a complete picture, and this concerned her. Beth had told her about breaking up with her boyfriend. Then there was the strange man in the overcoat with the deep voice who had given her a funny feeling. Then why all of a sudden was he in the yard, and why was Beth's car still there? When she thought it all through, she felt very concerned. So she hurried into her house and she called Peter Lochtefeldt. "Call it a woman's intuition," she said. On her first try, Barbara got Peter's answering machine. She then hung up and tried again. This time she began to leave a message. But just then, Peter walked into his house and heard Barbara's voice on his answering machine. "There's a person in the yard," she said to Peter, and for a split second there was silence on the other end. Then Peter said, "Just hang up, Barbara. I'm calling the police." So Beth had been staying with Peter, hiding from Tulin, so when Peter heard there was a man and that Beth's car was still there, he took that very seriously.
Yeah, and about the same time that the police broke down the front door of Beth's cottage, Tom Tulin was back at the Nantucket Memorial Airport. Dave Murphy from Hertz remembered him returning the car. And there was a surveillance camera at the airport recorded him putting a bag in a garbage can. That bag has never been found. Tulin got on a 12:50 p.m. flight to Hyannis. And then in Hyannis, he rented a Chevy Impala. He drove to a liquor store, bought a bottle of vodka and a six-pack of 7-Up. And then around 3:30 that afternoon, as two Rhode Island state troopers sat in their cruiser just off Interstate 95 near Hopkinton, Rhode Island, a bulletin for Tulin's rented Impala came out over the radio. And then about 10 minutes later, an Impala that matched the description came driving onto the Route 3 exit off of I-95. So the Hopkinton police and the Connecticut State Police joined the Rhode Island troopers, and they followed the Impala. And when the Impala finally pulled to the side of the road, police officers with their weapons drawn surrounded the car. So it's less than 4 hours after Beth Lochtefeldt had been murdered. Tulin was arrested. His days of facing no consequences were officially over. His parents, his extended family, and all of their influential friends has always been there to protect him. Now, as he sat in the back of the squad car, he was on his own.
He was, but certainly his parents would get him some good legal representation. So he wasn't on his own in the way some of us would be. He still had a lot of privilege. In 2007, Tom Tulin went to trial for the murder of Beth Lochtefeldt, and this was the first murder in Nantucket in over 20 years. In returning a verdict after 6 hours of deliberation, the jury rejected the defense's assertion that Tom Tulin had been temporarily insane when he committed the murder. The judge, Richard F. Conan of Nantucket Superior Court, sentenced Tom Tulin to life imprisonment without the chance of parole, and that was mandated by Massachusetts law. During closing arguments, Kevin Reddington, Tulin's lawyer, argued that his client had been addicted to drugs and alcohol since he was 14. He claimed that Mr. Tulin was mentally impaired by his addictions, as evidenced by a threat to throw himself off of the roof of a Manhattan building on the day Beth Lochtefeldt left for Nantucket. But Brian Glennie, the assistant district attorney, responded in his closing argument, "Mr. Tulin did not jump, did he? He was able to control his behavior." Mr. Glennie also set out a timeline as evidence that Tulin had made deliberate plans to murder Beth. He said the people Tulin encountered in the time before her killing, including airport security personnel and the worker at the car rental agency, testified that he had acted in a lucid fashion. Now, he was very drunk, but when you drink that much all the time, sometimes you can walk around and look completely normal.
Oh, yes.
How does that work?
Well, you're habituated to it. With any of those, you're shooting heroin, whatever, you name it, you need to increase the dosage to get the same effects from it.
So he could even just drink a fifth of vodka and still act pretty normally.
Sure.
All first-degree murder convictions are automatically appealed, and the state Supreme Judicial Court overturned the initial conviction in 2011, and they ordered a new trial, which would lead to the second trial. The Supreme Judicial Court said in its decision that there were flaws in the way the jury for the trial was selected, especially since Nantucket is such an insular community. The court ruled that many of the people in the jury pool had either direct ties to the victim's family or close ties to a potential witness in the case. And it definitely was that way because, remember her landlord, Barbara?
Mm-hmm.
It was her son who owned the marina where Tulin went and bought the knife.
Yeah. Well, everyone knows everybody.
Yes. Seems that way.
So during the second trial, which was in 2013, jurors listened to dozens of witnesses who testified about the weekend of Beth's murder, from their time in New York City, when Beth broke up with Tulin, to their final confrontation, when he stabbed her 23 times with a knife that he had bought upon arriving in Nantucket. So the jury in his second trial also didn't agree with the insanity defense and found him guilty.
Well, I think throughout history, we've had plenty of drunk people commit horrible crimes, and it's not an excuse.
Right.
It's just not. In 2020, he was granted a stay by the court as he switched lawyers. The last entries in the docket were for conferences, and there are no upcoming appearances scheduled. So he's in prison. Life in prison.
And likely to be there the rest of his life.
Let's hope so. I can have empathy for someone with an addiction problem, of course, but the violence and the persistence in it is just inexcusable to me. TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have comments, a case suggestion, or a beer recommendation, please be kind enough to send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. You can also go to our website to leave a comment or record a voicemail for a future show. I will also put a direct link in our show notes for you to click on and record your voicemail. If you're interested in getting your future TCB episodes commercial-free, getting an extra episode every month just for members, as well as a gift, please consider subscribing as a Tie Grabber on tiegrabber.com. We love our Tie Grabbers.
We certainly do.
Okay, so why don't we do a little feedback?
All right, I've got a voicemail and a couple emails for you.
All right, let's start with a voicemail from Bex with a case and beer suggestion.
Hey, Dick and Jill, this is Bex, and I just want to apologize. My St. Bernard is right next to me, and he might start panting loudly, as he often does. So I'm calling with a beer recommendation and case recommendation, so I'll try and be quick. So as for beers, I recently heard you guys on some feedback talking about getting a new beer from, I think it was Oklahoma. So I highly recommend Prairie Artisan Ales. I like to buy them from my local beer store, and they're delicious. Lots of great sours for Jill. As for cases, I notice you guys don't do unsolved cases usually. I don't know if that's a rule or not, but if you would consider one, the case of Asha Kramer, spelled K-R-E-I-M-E-R, is really interesting. She's Australian, but born in Hawaii and disappeared in California after 5 days of what seemed like a mental health crisis. So I think you could do a really great deep dive and a very thoughtful take on this case. So the other case I have for you, I know you're from New England, originally from Maine, I believe. And the case in New England is sometimes called the Otter Cliff murder, and it's from the late 80s and is the cases, actually plural, of Kathy Frost and Leslie Reynolds. And it's very odd and twisty, and the perpetrator almost got off scot-free. So highly recommend those, and thanks for delivering such wonderful podcasts. Talk to you soon.
Well, thank you, Bex. So yeah, we don't do a lot of unsolved, although I feel like when we do an unsolved, we kind of think we know who did it anyway. So maybe it doesn't seem very unsolved. I don't know. What do you think, Dickie?
Yeah, I think that's true. We very often have an idea of who the perpetrator is.
Right. So even if they haven't been convicted, it kind of feels like we know who did it, which I think a couple of recent ones were kind of like that.
Yeah.
So I want to start with the one at Acadia. Have you heard of this one? I didn't live in Maine yet in 87. I moved up there in the early 90s.
Yeah, no, this was just when I moved back to Maine.
Oh, okay.
So I'm only kind of peripherally aware of it.
All right.
But it's another one of those women falling from a height. Did she fall? Was she pushed? Or that type of thing.
Yep. Well, her husband was charged, so that's fascinating.
We'll have to dig into those and see.
Absolutely. And then what about Asha, who disappeared in 2015 with a mental health crisis going on? and no trace has ever been found. Now, that is mysterious.
Yeah, it is. That'd be one that might be interesting if we can get enough information about it.
That's another thing with the unsolved ones. Sometimes there isn't that much information to really make it a satisfying story for me personally anyway. All right, so we'll look into both of those and the beer. Thank you so much, Bex. And now we have a couple of emails. That's the only voicemail we're playing today, right? We got so many this week, but I guess this is the only one with a suggestion. The other ones are just super nice ones saying hi and telling us that we do a good job, basically. Correct?
Yes, there's a few more that I might need to take another look at. But at first blush, since we already had the one from Bex, I didn't pay that much attention. The ones I had were mostly praising us, that type of thing, which I know you just love to play.
Well, I love to hear it. I just don't love to play it for everybody because it seems a little bit...
I'll play it for you.
...yucky to do that.
Oh.
But...
I'll give you an audience.
Okay. But we do have an email from Aditi. Is that correct? Is that how you say it?
Yes. We have an email from Aditi and another one from Kristen.
Yeah, I'm going to start with Aditi and her case suggestion, or him. Sounds like a female name to me.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So, I'm going to read that email now.
Okay.
I have a fascinating case suggestion from India. This is a widely documented case, so you should find enough material to probably cover a story from this region. During the late 1970s, there was a smooth-talking con man posing as a gem salesman named Charles Sabraj. Really mutilated that name.
I think Sabraj is as close as I could get.
A French Indian national who went on a bizarre killing spree across India, Nepal, Thailand, Malaysia, and possibly more countries, and is responsible for killing anywhere between 12 and 20 people. He was unofficially nicknamed the Bikini Killer, since some of his first few victims' bodies were found wearing floral bikinis. His victims were often young backpackers from Europe and America. He would drug them, loot, and kill them, and then make off with their belongings. He would forge their passports, which he and his accomplices would use to travel with, all across Asia and Europe. In the end, it is believed that he also killed off his closest accomplice, but the body was never found. He was kind of a boogeyman story, often told to us kids as a cautionary tale about what to watch out for when traveling. Don't talk to strangers when you're traveling. Don't accept gifts or drinks or food from strangers in a strange city. Suspect everyone. I like that. Wise words. So it goes on. Charles Sabraj had become quite the celebrity because he created such sensational news every few years. He was wanted as a criminal in several countries, yet was able to evade arrest for years, stealthily moving across continents undetected. Even after he was captured and incarcerated in one of India's most secure jails, he managed to give authorities a slip in the most dramatic fashion and just walked out of the prison. He has escaped from various prisons on four different occasions and was finally apprehended in Kathmandu only when he made himself present in public and was spotted by a journalist, leading to his eventual arrest. Presently, he is serving a life sentence in the Kathmandu jail. Fascinating. Definitely want to look into that.
It is, and they had done a mini-series based on his crimes. I started watching, I forget the name of it. You watched a little bit of it with me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I watched four episodes. Fascinating.
All right, great. Well, that sounds really good. So thank you, Aditi.
And then Kristen has a case suggestion for us.
All right, why don't you read her email?
I have to say, you guys are total couple goals for my husband and I.
Oh, thank you, Kristen.
He loves beer and I love true crime. Maybe one day we can figure out how to blend them as well as you two do.
That's nice.
I wanted to recommend a case for you. This is Riley Fox of Wilmington, Illinois. A truly fascinating case. That summer day, I was working at the gas station in town while the search parties were looking for her. I remember so clearly the heartbreak of the whole town when she was found murdered later that afternoon. The case features a false confession, a bumbling police investigation, a parolee, and a very familiar attorney.
I like how Kristen listed those. It kind of reminds me of Stefan from Saturday Night Live. How he lists things, you know?
I know how difficult it is for you guys to cover children's cases, but I feel it is really important because of how relevant it still is today. My first child was born 5 years after this case, and it definitely still impacts my parenting today.
Well, how could it not?
Absolutely. 2020 covered this case earlier this year, so hopefully there's enough information to be found. Thanks, Kristen.
That is very fascinating.
Yeah, so we'll look that up too.
Yes, and it seems a little bit familiar. I may have heard of it. So definitely some great case suggestions, though. So thank all of you for sending them in. We do appreciate them. Even if you haven't heard yours, it may be that we're going to play it later or that it's something we've at least discussed. So if you send in any feedback, I just want everyone to know that we do read all of it and we do appreciate all of it very much.
Absolutely.
Yes. So thank you, everyone, for listening, as well as for your feedback. We really appreciate it, and we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll save a few chairs for you.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys. Thank you.